the lead prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. I think he was in Rafah just a few days ago. We see the world's response, or the West's response, when it came to Russia invading Ukraine and occupying Ukraine. Karim Khan, very soon after, opened a whole investigation into crimes against humanity that Putin was committing in Ukraine. Can you respond to the difference in approach to Russia and Ukraine and Israel and the occupied territories? Officially, international law, the OPT, the occupied Palestinian territories.
Well, there has been a stunning inconsistency with the rapidity with which the court was able to move and the prosecutor was able to move with regard to Ukraine, and the years upon years in which it has dragged its feet with regard to Palestine. This is just one of many critiques of the court, including the fact that it does not have a very strong record of holding northern countries, Israel, the United States, and others, to account for their crimes under international criminal law, and yet is very anxious to move forward on cases in the global south. Now, that is not to condemn the court. The court is a young institution. It needs to be strengthened. It needs to insulate itself from the kinds of political pressure that have led to its inaction in the case of Palestine. But our hope ultimately is the peaceful resolution of disputes through the use of international law. And if that's going to happen, we need a robust and fair international criminal court that doesn't provide for exceptionalism for powerful countries of the north, like Israel, for example, but that holds all perpetrators of international crimes to account. The court has a long way to go before it's going to have the reputation that will bring confidence globally that it's meeting its mandate under the Rome Statute.
On Monday, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre compared pro-Palestinian protesters to the white supremacists who took part in the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017. She made the comment in response to a question from Fox News's Peter Ducey.
Doesn't Biden think the anti-Israel protesters in this country are extremists?
What I can say is what we've been very clear about this. When it comes to anti-Semitism, there is no place. We have to make sure that we speak against it very loud and be very clear about that. Remember, what the president decided to, when the president decided to run for president is what he saw in Charlottesville in 2017, when he saw neo-Nazis marching down the streets of Charlottesville with vile anti-Semitic just hatred. And he was very clear then, and he's very clear now. He's taken actions against this over the past 2 years, and he's continued to be clear. There is no place, no place for this type of vile and despite this kind of rhetoric.
So that's President Biden's spokesperson, Karine Jean-Pierre. Craig McIver, your response.
Well, I think one of the most disturbing aspects of this current situation in the North, in countries like the U.S. and in Europe, has been this rather unprecedented crackdown on human rights defenders speaking up to defend the human rights of people in Gaza during this situation. And that has come from official statements that try to critique in that way people who are defending human rights, and to compare them with far-right neo-fascist protesters, for example. I mean, it's an outrageous comparison to make. And it doesn't stop there. We have also seen very strong efforts on the part of government institutions, including local governments and state governments and the federal government and universities and employers and others, to punish people for daring to speak up criticizing the human rights violations that are happening or criticizing the U.S. role in these violations. But I think what is most hopeful, Amy, and where there is a glimmer of hope, which is, I have to say, moved me very much, it's that people are not allowing themselves to be intimidated by these tactics. We have seen massive demonstrations in all parts of the country and in Europe from people many times risking arrest, risking police beatings, risking other consequences because they refuse to allow this to go forward and to have the human rights claim be silenced. And I think most encouraging, we have seen, you know, just a few blocks from here, a few days ago, we saw a large group organized by Jewish Voices for Peace, if not now, of Jewish protesters standing up and saying, not in our name, and taking over Grand Central Station, and in one move, stripping away the Israeli propaganda point that they are somehow acting in the defense of Jews. Jewish people are not represented by Israel. These protesters have made that perfectly clear. Israel pushes an old anti-Semitic trope that it somehow represents Jewish people around the world. Not only is that not factual, but it's very dangerous. And everyone needs to know that Israel is a state that's responsible for its own crimes. And that responsibility does not extend to our Jewish brothers and sisters, many of whom are standing up alongside Muslim and Christian and others in demonstrations across this country and across Europe, saying that this must end.
I wanted to get your response to a comment in The Guardian by Anne Baevsky, who directs Touro College's Institute on Human Rights and the Holocaust in New York, who accused you of overt anti-Semitism, saying you'd used UN letterhead to call for wiping Israel off the map. Craig McIver, if you could respond.
Well, Anne Baevsky is a well-known entity amongst human rights defenders. She has made a career of attacking anyone who dares to criticize Israeli human rights violations in particular. I have responded to this idea of wiping Israel off the map by saying I'm not looking for an end to Israel, I'm looking for an end to apartheid. And it's very telling what Anne Baevsky tweeted in her attack on me. She accused me of anti-Semitism, and the quote that she took from my letter to prove that was my call for equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. I had to reply to her tweet by saying that she had become a parody of herself, because if calling for equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews is a new form of anti-Semitism, then there's no conversation to be had. But I don't think people are falling for these smears anymore. They are almost automatic. But the point needs to be made again and again that criticism of Israeli human rights violations is not anti-Semitic. Just as criticism of Saudi violations is not Islamophobic, criticism of Myanmar violations is not anti-Buddhist, criticism of Indian violations is not anti-Hindu. If any of those are true, then there is no international human rights framework. And if only the case of Israel is true, well, that's a racist proposition that only Palestinians can't have their human rights defended in this globe. So I don't think anyone listens too much to those kinds of smears anymore. And luckily, people are speaking up louder, not lowering their voices to demand human rights in the occupied territories.
So what do you go off to do, Craig McIver? I mean, you've been at the United Nations for decades. Talk about your plans now. Today is your first day that you're not working at the UN.
Well, I intend to remain involved in the cause of international human rights, in which I've been involved since 1980, in fact. There's no question about that. I will do it under my own name, unconstrained by diplomatic protocol and the constraints of the UN. I will continue to support my colleagues. I don't want to leave the impression that I'm criticizing the whole UN. You know, UN humanitarian workers, UN human rights workers, the UNRWA colleagues in Gaza, dozens of whom have lost their life just in the last couple of weeks under Israeli bombs, are doing absolutely heroic work all around the world. But I want to try to influence the political side of the House to take up a more realistic and principled approach to this particular conflict, one based in international human rights, one based in international humanitarian law, and one based in achievable goals, if not in the immediate term, of a paradigm based upon equality, an end to apartheid, and as I said, equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews.
I wanted to get your final response to the protesters just yesterday in Washington, D.C., in the Senate, repeatedly disrupting Secretary of State Antony Blinken while he was testifying before the Senate on President Biden's request for $106 billion for Ukraine, Israel, and militarizing U.S.-Mexico border. A group of protesters with members of Muslims for Just Futures and Detention Watch Network sitting behind Blinken held up their hands covered in fake blood. He was also interrupted by members of Code Pink, including the former State Department official Anne Wright, who resigned over the Iraq War. This is what she said.
I say no more.
If you don't stop them, you're trying to get
arrested. We've got to have a ceasefire. I'm going to shut up.
passionately.
Yeah, relax.
No more money for war.
Be gentle.
No more money for war. No more money for killing 8,300 people in Gaza. 3,500 kids dead. Come on, I'm an Army colonel. I'm a former diplomat. I resigned on that war in Iraq that you talked about. That was a terrible thing, and what we're doing right now is supporting Israel's genocide of Gaza is a terrible thing, too.
She was holding a sign as she was taken out by security, ceasefire in Gaza. Craig McIver, your final comments.
Well, this is where I find the most hope, Amy. I have lost confidence in official institutions of government after all these years in the international human rights movement. I am losing hope in international, important parts of international institutions. Where there is hope, it is in civil society. It is in those ordinary people here in the United States and elsewhere who are willing to stand up and demand respect for human life and for human rights.
International human rights lawyer Craig McIver, who recently resigned from his post as director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. When we come back, we speak with another dissenter, Josh Paul, who resigned from the State Department to protest the Biden administration's push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege on Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. We end this special with Josh Paul. In October, he resigned from the State Department to protest the Biden administration's push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege on Gaza, calling it short-sighted, destructive, and contradictory. Paul had served as director of congressional and public affairs for the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, which oversees arms transfers to Israel and other nations. In his resignation letter, he wrote, quote, "We cannot be both against occupation and for it. We cannot be both for freedom and against it. And we cannot be for a better world while contributing to one that is materially worse. I believe to the core of my soul that the response Israel is taking, and with it the American support both for that response and for the status quo of the occupation, will only lead to more and deeper suffering for both the Israeli and the Palestinian people, and is not in the long-term American interest," he wrote. I asked Josh Paul to talk about why he resigned from the State Department.
Yes, thank you. I decided to resign for three reasons, the first and most pressing of which is the very, I believe, uncontroversial fact that U.S.-provided arms should not be used to massacre civilians, should not be used to result in massive civilian casualties. And that is what we are seeing in Gaza, and what we were seeing, you know, very soon after the October 7th horrific attack by Hamas. I do not believe arms should be, U.S.-provided arms should be used to kill civilians. It is that simple. Secondly, I also believe that, you know, as your previous guest identified, there is no military solution here, and we are providing arms to Israel on a path that has not led to peace, has not led to security, neither for Palestinians nor for Israelis. It is a moribund process and a dead-end policy. And yet, when I tried to raise both of these concerns with State Department leadership, there was no appetite for discussion, no opportunity to, you know, look at any of the potential arms sales and raise concerns about them, simply a directive to move forward as quickly as possible. And so I felt I had to resign.
So talk more about that. Talk more about what kind of dialogue goes on at the State Department. And if you, for example, have met with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, not to mention President Biden, to voice your concerns. And what about other veteran State Department officials?
So typically there is a very robust policy process in the State Department for arms transfers, and there are a lot of those, right? So we're talking about 20,000 arms sale cases a year that the State Department processes, which could be anything from bullets to radios to fighter jets. And for each of those, there is a lengthy process sometimes that looks at, you know, what are the pros and cons of the sale? What are its human rights implications? That has not happened in this context for Israel. And as I say, when I raised those concerns against the existing laws, against the existing policies, there was no appetite for that discussion. I have not personally spoken to Secretary Blinken about this, nor certainly to President Biden. But I know that in the time since I left, there has been increasing discussion within the State Department, but has not led to any change of policies. In fact, as you heard earlier on your show, Vice President Harris was just saying yesterday that we will not place any conditions whatsoever on our arms to Israel. And that is unlike any arms transfer decision I've ever been a part of. There's always discussion about should we condition this to address human rights issues.
So who's leading this, Josh Paul? Who is preventing this? Who is suppressing all of this discussion within the State Department?
I honestly think in some ways it is coming from the very top of the U.S. government and from the Biden White House. You know, there are many in the State Department and across government who have reached out to me in recent weeks since I left to express their support, but also to say how difficult and how horrific they are finding U.S. policy and yet are being told when they try to raise these concerns, look, you can get emotional support. If you're finding this difficult, we'll find you something else to work on. But don't question the policy because it's coming from the top.
The HuffPost has this new piece that reports a task force on preventing atrocities did not meet until 2 weeks into the war, and officials say department leaders are telling them their expertise won't affect policy. Explain what goes on.
So whenever there is a crisis, as there is right now in Israel and Gaza, the department sets up a task force or multiple task forces that are uniquely shaped to address that crisis. So, for example, in the context of an earthquake, they might bring in experts on, you know, refugee issues, on weather issues, on disease issues, you know, that sort of, you know, broad swath of people. In the context of Gaza, they have set up a task force to look at this problem. But according to the report you cite, it does not include the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, who are responsible for, you know, U.S. support to refugee issues. So it is either a stunning oversight or it is an intentional disregard for the humanity of Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
At a meeting on October 26, a State Department source told you they recalled a top official advising staff to shift their focus away from Israel-Palestine and seek to make a difference in other parts of the world.
So I don't believe that that was a conversation that I had with someone, but that is in the same report in the Huffington Post that you cite. Yes.
So they're directing them not even to make comments on this, just stop talking about Israel-Palestine.
Yes, that's right. And I think, look, I mean, that reflects a tension or a censorship, right, that we are seeing not only in the U.S. government. I think what's interesting here is that there is this censorship that has existed and expanded, you know, to colleges and universities, where you talked about the doxing. I've also heard from many people across the American private sector, both from the Arab American community, but also more broadly from all sorts of diverse communities, who've said, we are afraid to speak up on this because we are in fear of our jobs. It's the same climate in government, and that is just not American.
So I wanted to ask you about this In These Times report that the White House has requested an unprecedented loophole in arms spending to allow it to be able to conduct arms deals with Israel in complete secrecy without oversight from Congress or the public.
Yes. So we provide Israel with $3.3 billion a year in foreign military financing, which is the State Department and U.S. government's primary function or primary mechanism for funding the sale of arms to other countries. Of note, you know, we typically provide, setting aside Ukraine, about $6 billion a year in foreign military financing around the world. So Israel already gets more than half of that. The language in the supplemental request that the Biden administration sent up, would remove the requirement to notify Congress of any arms sales conducted under that funding. Typically, there is a process where for any major defense sale, Congress is notified of it. And there's actually a process prior to the formal notification where Congress gets to ask questions, poke, prod, delay, and then if it wishes to oppose a sale, can raise a joint resolution of disapproval on the floor. What this proposal would do is essentially destroy all of that, remove all of that, remove that congressional oversight, remove that congressional ability to object. It is unprecedented. I've never seen anything like it. And I cannot imagine that the committees of jurisdiction are viewing it very favorably, because it is just, you know, such a damaging approach that also sets horrible precedent for other countries with whom, you know, future administrations may decide they don't want Congress to be involved.
Since you are in charge of arms sales, what does this $14 billion that, well, it looks like both houses want to send it to Israel. It's just that the House one is controversial because they want to take that $14 billion from the IRS. And also they want to sever the funding for Israel from the funding for Ukraine. And Chuck Schumer, the Senate majority leader, says he won't consider this bill. But it sounds like there is enough support in both houses for that extra, not the 3.8 or 3.3 billion yearly aid to Israel, but an extra $14 billion. You're the expert on arms sales. What would it be used for?
Yeah, and let me just say, I think there is, you know, almost or near unanimous congressional support for this further military assistance to Israel. And I think what's fascinating about that is also there's a massive disconnect between where Congress is on these issues and where, I think, if you look at the polling, the American public are. And I think the current crisis is really crystallizing that difference. I don't think it will make any difference in terms of the passage of this package, but it may do down the line. With regards to this package specifically, it includes $3.5 billion in foreign military financing. Israel can draw on that to purchase essentially what it wants. And what's unusual about this as well, in addition to the removal of the notification, is that Israel would be entitled, under the proposal sent to Congress, to spend all of this money within its own defense industry. Israel is, of course, a top 10 exporter of arms around the world, often competing with the United States. And the idea that we will be providing funding to subsidize that competition is really unimaginable. But on top of that, the package also provides further funding from the Defense Department side for air and missile defense for Israel, for Iron Dome. And let me be clear, my concern here is on lethal assistance to Israel. When it comes to protecting civilians from rocket attacks, I believe that they should be. I don't believe anyone should have to live in fear of their homes, in their homes, from rockets raining down on them. Although I believe that's the case whether they are in Israel under Iron Dome, or whether they are in Gaza, for example. And, of course, we never ask that question. The funding, finally, would also include research and development funding for equipment such as there is a experimental laser project called Iron Beam, which the U.S. and Israel are working together on, air and missile defense system. If this is an emergency request, why are we looking at research and development for projects that have not even materialized yet? That doesn't sound like an emergency to me. So as with the arms transfers I saw when I was departing from the department, I think there is just a rush to push everything they can while they feel there is a window of political opportunity here where there will be no significant opposition.
What kind of response was there to your resignation?
So To my resignation, I would say there has been an overwhelming response that I've heard from folks, from colleagues inside not only the State Department, but across the U.S. government, actually, on the Hill, in the Defense Department, in the uniformed military services, including in combatant commands around the world. People have reached out to me to say, you know, we fully agree with you. You know, obviously, everyone has their own personal circumstances. You know, I think if we had universal health care, it would make it a bit easier for people to stand up on principle. I myself am, you know, trying to figure out what I do next on health care. But the point is that so many people have reached out to say, we hear you, we agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the things I found is that a lot of people can be in individual offices and say, there is no, I can't speak up because I will lose my job, I will put my career in jeopardy. And there's no one else here I can talk to. And yet I'm hearing from someone else just a few desks over who's saying the same thing. So I think there really is a communications crisis, a transparency crisis within the U.S. government, and a policy crisis, because when you can't talk about foreign policy, when you can't debate, when you can't criticize, you don't end up with good policy.
Josh Paul, why was this the last straw for you? I mean, for example, if you were in charge of weapons sales, presumably you were dealing with Saudi Arabia, notoriously authoritarian. U.S. agencies concluded, even in just one case, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was responsible for this. You oversaw arms sales to them, presumably. Why Israel?
So let me just be clear. I was one of multiple people involved in the arms sales process. Arms sales themselves are a presidential authority that is delegated to the Secretary of State and then through the Secretary of State to the Undersecretary, who is actually responsible for approving them for the most part. But you're right. And as I said in my resignation letter, in my time in the department, I dealt with many, you know, morally challenging, controversial arms sales. I think what made the difference for me here is that for all of those previous instances, even under the Trump administration, mind you, there was always room for discussion and debate, and the ability to mitigate some of the worst possible outcomes, to delay sales until, you know, crises had passed so that they weren't contributing immediately into a humanitarian crisis, to work with Congress and be confident that once the policy debate had ended in State Department, there would be a congressional piece to it, too. And Congress genuinely has stood up in the past repeatedly on matters of human rights and arms sales. What was different here was that there was none of that. There was no debate. There was no space for debate, and there was also no congressional appetite or willingness to have debate.
There's going to be a major march in Washington tomorrow. 350 people are arrested in Philly. We're going to play some clips of a major protest in Boston that happened last night. How much does grassroots protests like this, the thousands of people are protesting around the country, the shutdown of Grand Central by Jewish groups just last Friday night, have on the State Department, on the White House?
So I don't think it has much impact on the State Department. And that's okay, because I think policy processes are meant to happen within a policy framework. Again, the problem is they're not happening. I think it does have an impact on the White House. I think we've seen a significant change in tone in the last few weeks, not because there is a sudden deep care, frankly, for Palestinian civilian casualties on their own merits, but because there is a sense that there is a political crisis here developing for the Biden administration, that many people are saying, you know, we're just going to sit out the next election. We have lost faith in this White House, in this administration. So I think that does have an impact. And let me also say, I have found it incredibly moving as well to watch these protests. You know, I was up on the Hill for meetings, you know, this week and last week, and came across in one office a sit-in that was happening where there was a group of Jewish students singing peace songs and holding up signs that said, Save Gaza. I found that incredibly moving. And I think it also tells Congress and it tells this administration that they are not in line with much of American public opinion. I think it's a much-needed message.
Josh Paul, veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in October in protest of a push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst the attack on Gaza. Visit democracynow.org to see all of our coverage on Gaza and Israel. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, and Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.